Welcome to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on economic and social forces that are predicted to have major impacts across sectors and around the globe. Three trends, the information revolution, economic globalization, and population surges, are transforming our world. To discuss their effects, we'll hear from Tom Friedman, foreign affairs correspondent for The New York Times, and James Manyika, director of the McKinsey Global Institute. This episode was recorded before a World Affairs Council audience as part of our Global Business Forum. And now to the conversation.
Thank you all for coming to this discussion. I'm thrilled to be doing this with Tom.
Vice versa.
Tom is a hero of mine. I always think of Tom. I always think of Tom as, when I think of Tom, I think about somebody who is an acute observer of the world in all its different facets, whether it's economic, technological, political, whatever. He's an acute observer of the world. He's also is able to generate remarkable insights from those observations. And, you know, and then last of all, he writes it really well and actually makes it interesting to read and sort of understandable. So I'm delighted to be. I've been a huge fan of Tom for a very long time. What we thought we would do today, in fact, what we were asked to do, is to essentially have a conversation. And in fact, we're encouraged to pretend that you all are not here, and we're having an argument and a debate. Yeah. Maybe it's a better version of the presidential debates, yeah. I don't know.
But that would not be hard.
So we thought we would have a conversation. We're going to wander around quite a bit, touch on various topics.
But James, I'd just say a couple things. First of all, thank you for being here. You know, I've always thought of myself as a great acorn collector. That's really how I see my work. I go out in the world and I find these acorns. And my great good fortune is that I have about a half a dozen people around the world who help me crack them and find the nuts and the food inside. And James is one of them. So it's a real pleasure to be here. With you, and I've been such a fan of, and I consider myself almost quasi-partner of McKinsey Global Institute all these years. You know, to begin with, I'm really here to learn more than to speak. I thought I would ask James to begin by talking about the book that he and his partners at MGI have written, No Ordinary Disruption. And I love that title because and I'll talk a little bit after about the book I'm working on, because there's one thing I am absolutely convinced of: the inflection point we are going through now, James, is no ordinary disruption. Tell us why.
Well, I think we agree on that. I mean, I think part of the motivation for us to do this book was we've been studying economies for a very long time, and you know how economies grow and perform and so forth. And if you look at the last 40, 50 years, we've actually gone through a remarkable period. And I'm saying the last 40 or 50, maybe up until the recession hit in 2008. It was a pretty remarkable period. If you think about it, we had a huge demographic dividend. We had the baby boomer generation, labor supply was largely abundant, and in fact, we saw incredible GDP growth and productivity growth in large part because of that demographic dividend. We also had a period where quite frankly, macroeconomic volatility was relatively benign. Yes, there were blips along the way, but if you looked at it on the whole, in the long run, it was a largely a macro, you know, benign period.
As was geopolitics.
As was geopolitics, to that matter. Yeah. And then if you look at other things like resources and commodities, they were progressively getting cheaper and cheaper, even if you take into account the oil crisis in the 70s. I mean, essentially, the line, if you draw a line, it basically goes down in terms of cheaper and cheaper resources. Similarly, if you look at the cost of capital, what it takes to get capital was progressively getting cheaper and cheaper, which then led to, if you like, asset accumulation and increasing leverage from the asset accumulation, whether it's houses and other things. So it was a fairly remarkably benign period. Mm-hmm. The thing that, if you then look forward to where we are, the recent economic crisis notwithstanding, we sort of see four kind of big trends or forces, if you like, that are kind of changing everything. And what's interesting about the four forces is both the fact that they're happening all at the same time, which is quite remarkable. One of them would be big enough by itself. They're happening at vastly larger scale and at a much, much faster rate. Let me describe them. So the first one, if you think about the aging population, so if you look at the last, most of the advanced economies, so if you take the 20 largest economies in the world, that make up close to 90% of the world's GDP, they went through essentially a demographic dividend. Their populations were rising, and we know that matters because economic growth is tied to expansions of labor supply and population. More young people working, the baby boomer generation. And by the way, we also had an incredible boom in terms of fertility rates went, helped a lot.
Yes.
And we know that, we extended life expectancy. So the whole population led to just a huge demographic dividend. If you look forward, it doesn't look like that at all, actually. In fact, for most of those 20 largest economies, most of them by 2050 would have reached peak labor supply. In fact, some are already there. If you look at countries like Russia, they're already below replacement rates in terms of their population growth. China is headed that way, mostly because of the one-child policy. So this thing that we've benefited from, which is the demographic dividend, is essentially going to reverse. Mm-hmm. The other big shift that you also see is the fact that we now have a shift of the structure of the global economy that's going basically east, becoming more urban, and giving rise to a new consumer class. So if you actually drew a map of the economic center of the global economy, it would be mostly somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic up until very recently. Mm-hmm. It's been shifting east, mostly because of the rise of China. I always think that it's quite remarkable to think about just how quickly it's shifted. So if you take, if you think about the Industrial Revolution, which you think of as having been a big transformational trend, and what that did to incomes per capita and the growth of prosperity, it took the United Kingdom basically about 154 years to double GDP per capita, working off a base population of, 9 million people. It took the United States something like 50 years to double GDP per capita. It's taken China 12 years to double GDP per capita, working off a base population of 1 billion people.
Yeah.
So just the scale, I mean, India has taken about 16 years to do essentially the same thing. So just the massive shift of the global economy east is huge. You can say, well, that's just economies, but you can see it in the companies as well. So if you take companies, for example, as recently as 2000, something like only 5% of the global Fortune 500 was actually outside of the Western Europe and the United States. Today, it's already about 26% of the global Fortune 500 are outside of the Western Europe and the United States. By 2050, half of them will be outside of Western Europe and the United States. Mm. So this is happening at all levels. So this shift east is huge. Let me mention one other thing related to the second force about the shift, is what we call the consuming class. So the consuming class, you can define that in terms of when people start to live above poverty levels and are now in the category of income, adjusted for purchasing power and all of that, where they can start to buy products, goods, and services. So we call that the consuming class. And that's typically when people adjusted for currencies and so forth are earning more than $10 a day. The size of that population, up until very recently, used to be only about 15% of the global population. By 2025, it'll be close to half of the world's population. The majority of them are going to be in these emerging economies, mostly east. So the size of the world's economically consuming class is going to grow by about 3 billion people, most of them not here, in other places. So that's a big part of this big shift. And then you've got what's happening with cities. Let me point to the other two trends very quickly. The third one is what's happening with technology. We've seen a huge raft of disruptive, amazing, interesting, transformational technologies. And what's fascinating about them is that there's actually lots of them, whether you're talking about cloud computing, the internet, robotics, AI, what's happening with synthetic bio, there's a whole raft of them. What's amazing about most of them is that the rate at which you're adopting these things is pretty phenomenal, right? If you go back, it took the telephone something like, 110 years or something like that to reach the first 50 million people. It took You know, it's taken Facebook a year to get to the first 50 million people. Angry Birds took 3 months, by the way, to get to the first. I mean, so just the pace and rate of adoption is just phenomenal. So you couple that with, you know, many more people able to afford and consume these things at a rapidly, dramatically, you know, accelerated pace. These were changes that in the past would take multiple generations for a society to live through and adjust. And yet they're happening within our individual lifestyle. The final one is just what's happening with how much more connected the world is. So it's fascinating. If you think about all the things of economic value that move around the world, right? So, you know, trade of, you know, goods, products, and commodities, but also services, trade, and flows, financial flows, people flows. We're going to talk about migration here shortly, yes, at some point, I think. And even data flows. All of those are growing at phenomenal rates. What's fascinating about those, you know, how much more interconnected the world is, first of all, it's digital. Digital is the fastest growing part of that, the technology-driven interconnectivity. But you also see the structure of the economy changing. So if you had looked at the world as recently as 20 years ago, something like, in economic value terms, something like 80% of all these flows around the world were concentrated amongst a few countries and a few large countries and a few companies. And most of those countries were Western European or American. And if they traded with anybody, it was mostly, you know, advanced grain to developed. But it was very concentrated. Now it's very different. Now you have many, many more countries participating in these flows, many, many more types of companies, both large and small. And quite often, we're not involved. So the rate of kind of south-to-south flows that are going on are just huge. China trading with Africa, Asia trading within itself, Asia trading with Latin America. So the structure of the global connectivity and flows has just changed dramatically. So I think all of this put together means that, you know, each of these things by itself would be quite dramatic. But having all four of these things happening at the same time, at the pace and scale that they are, and we are having to adjust and, you know, adapt to these, is going to create some interesting, you know, times in the next several years.
Fantastic, you know.
But I want to hear about your book.
It's our books overlap. I'm working on a book right now, and it's tentatively called "Thank You for Being Late," the title comes very organically out of, I would be meeting people in Washington, D.C. for breakfast, happened over the last year, and people would come 15, 20 minutes late. They'd say, Mr. Freeman, I'm so sorry. It was the weather, the traffic, the subway, the dog ate my homework. I found myself spontaneously saying to them, James, no, actually, thank you for being late. Because you were late, I actually been eavesdropping on their conversation. I've been people watching the lobby, fantastic. And I just connected two ideas I've been struggling with for the last 2 months.
So they gave you back your time.
I mined time. So I started telling people, actually, thank you for being late. And they started answering, well, you're welcome. Okay. And so, but there's a method to that madness, because the book really could be called The World is Fast. And that may, in fact, be the subtitle. So I'll just give you a little bit of it, but I live in Bethesda, Maryland, and I take the subway to work once a week. And a year ago, in October, I took the subway to work, and that involves me driving from my home in Bethesda to the Bethesda Hyatt on Wisconsin Avenue, and I park in the public parking garage beneath the Bethesda Hyatt. And I did that in October, and went to D.C., came back on the subway, driving out of the public parking garage, get to the cashier's booth, hand the man my timestamp ticket, and he looked at it and looked at me and said, I know who you are. I said, great. I read your column. Great, okay. I don't always agree. Okay, get me out of here. All right. And I drove off. A week later, I took my weekly subway trip to D.C. Went into D.C., came back, driving out of the parking lot, cashier's booth, same guy's there. And this time he looks around and says, Mr. Friedman, I have my own blog. Would you read my blog? And I thought, oh my God. the parking guy is now my competitor. So I said, well, write it down for me and I'll look at it. And he wrote it down on a little yellow 3M pad. It was called odinambi.com. He wrote about Ethiopian politics. And when I got home, I called it up. And it was nice, you know, a blog about, he was from the Oromo people and wrote about Ethiopian politics. And but I thought about it, James, I thought about him. And for about a week, and I decided this was a message from God. You need to talk to this guy. That this encounter was telling me something. So unfortunately, his email wasn't on his blog, so I started taking the subway every day and parking there to see if we would overlap, because I didn't have his email. It was the only way, and it took about a week. And finally, I got there, I parked, I stopped under the arm up, and I said, Yili, now I know his name, give me your email. If you wouldn't mind. And he happily did. And that night I sent him an email. I reproduced all the emails. Our exchanges are kind of funny in the book. And I said, I sent him my email, I have a proposition for you. I'm going to teach you how to write a column. And you will tell me your life story. So he said, I see you're proposing a deal. I like this deal. So we agreed to meet near his office, near, as he put it, near at Pete's Coffee House in Bethesda, a week later. And he told me his life story. He's a great story, Ethiopian immigrant, economics major from Haile Selassie University, came here, was blogging on Ethiopian websites, but they were too slow. And so he decided they wouldn't turn his stuff around fast enough, decided to start his own blog. His Google metrics say he's read in a dozen countries. Now, Mr. Friedman, I feel empowered. So I then prepared for him a 6-page memo on how to write a column. And I explained to him that a news story is meant to inform.
Can we all get that?
This is the first chapter. So I explained to him that a news story is meant to inform. And it can do so better or worse. But a column is meant to provoke. It's meant to produce a reaction. So I'm either in the heating business or the lighting business, okay? I'm either stoking up an emotion inside of you, or I'm illuminating something for you, and either way, I'm producing a reaction. And if I do it right, I'll produce one of a dozen reactions, which I explained to him. One is, I didn't know that. Read my comments. I said, no, that's a good one. I never looked at it that way. That's a good one. I never connected those things. That's a good one. Your favorite, you live for this, happens once every 2 months. You said exactly what I felt but didn't know how to say. God bless you, Mr. Friedman, God bless you. I want to kill you dead, you and all your offspring, okay? So I went through all 12 for him. And but then I explained to him that to produce heat or light requires a chemical reaction. And it requires mixing three compounds to produce a column. One is your own value set. What do you stand for? Are you a libertarian, capitalist, a socialist, a communist, a Keynesian, a Marxist? What is your value set? How do you lean into the world? Second, how do you think the machine works? So the machine is always the working hypothesis I'm carrying around in my head for what are the biggest forces shaping more things in more ways, in more places, on more days. Because as a columnist, what you're trying to do is take your value set and push the machine in one direction or another. And if you don't know how it works, you either won't push it anywhere or you'll push it in the wrong direction. And lastly, what have you learned about people and culture? Because ain't no column without people and culture. How does the machine affect different people and culture, and how different people and cultures respond and push the machine? Mix them all together, do it right, stir, bake for 45 minutes, and you will produce either heat or light. And so the chapter is really all about, I'm talking to him, obviously, to him, through him to the reader, about how I go about organizing, how I look at the world. And the flip to the rest of the book, and I will stop here, is, well, if that's what a column is, what is my value set? What have I been? Where do I come from? How do I think the machine works today? And what have I learned about people and culture? So the next chapter is called Always Looking for Minnesota. Because I grew up in Minnesota in the 50s and 60s in a time and a place when politics worked. And I grew up under Mondale, Humphrey, McCarthy, and I grew up in a freaky suburb of small town outside of Minneapolis called St. Louis Park in a sort of 10 square mile area with Al Franken, Norm Ornstein, the Cohn brothers, Michael Sandel, Peggy Ornstein. Wow. We all grew up and went to the same high school, and we all actually went to the same Hebrew school. And the Coen Brothers movie, A Serious Man, was about our Hebrew school.
Oh, okay. Wow.
There's all kind of homages to St. Louis Park in the Coen Brothers movies. If you see No Country for Old Men, if you remember the scene where Churgub goes into a drugstore in Mexico City, or Mexico across the border, and blows up a car to distract them while he goes in to get drugs. The drugstore is called Mike Zoss Pharmacy. That was our local pharmacy in St. Louis Park. Okay. So the chapter really, though, is all about St. Louis Park, which was a very strange suburb. All the Jews lived in a ghetto in North Minneapolis, basically. And in the late 50s, they moved en masse to one suburb because all the others had redlining. They couldn't get houses, including my parents. And so a suburb that was basically 100% Scandinavian, Protestant and Catholic, overnight became 20% Jewish. And the chapter is about how you build real pluralism and tolerance. And I've gone back and re-interviewed all my high school teachers who are still alive and whatnot. And then the next section is about how the machine works, which is a lot about what you're talking about. And the last part is about people and culture. That's what I'm working on.
Well, actually, I'd like to pick up on that. So if you take the trends I described as the machine, if you like, and you take the people and culture and society and the politics you're describing, how do you think these two things are coping and adapting to each other?
So my short answer is, I'd really like you to pick up on this, because our views of the world overlap as they should, because we're looking at a lot of the same phenomena. So I think the biggest thing shaping more things in more places in more ways on more days is that the three largest forces on the planet, which I call the market, Mother Nature, and Moore's Law, are all in simultaneous nonlinear acceleration. So if you were to put Moore's Law, the speed and power of microchips will double every 24 months, on a graph, it looks like this. And if you put climate change and biodiversity loss and population, it looks like this. And if you put globalization, the world going from connected to hyperconnected to interconnected to interdependent, it looks like this. So all three graphs look like a hockey stick. And I believe I can explain more things in more places, in more ways, on more days. Right. By those three accelerations happening at the same time. Because more Moore's Law drives more globalization, right. More globalization drives more biodiversity loss.
Right. But here's the challenge, though. People don't adapt to things according to that hockey stick you just described, right? Whether it's in terms of people building skills to cope with the change, society, or even our politics adapting to those changes. It doesn't look like that.
Yeah. So it's very interesting you say that, James. I was down at Google X 2 weeks ago and interviewed Astro Teller, and I was telling him about the book, and we were talking about what's going on, and he took out a little, again, yellow notepad. I should actually saved all these yellow notepads where people wrote these things. And he took out a little yellow notepad, and he drew two lines. And one line, this was the rate of change axis, and this is the timeline. So the first line was almost straight, but with a slight positive slope. That's the pace at which human beings adapt and evolve. Then he drew another line that looked like this. That's the pace of technological change. And he took the intersection, and then he went a quarter inch above the intersection and said, this is where we are. Okay, so we're at a point now where technology is evolving faster than human beings can adapt. And so I think the fundamental challenge we have, and what will determine a lot of our stability or instability, will be two things. One is, and I have to credit Tony Fadell of Nest for really articulating this so well. A huge amount rides on whether we have AI or IA. If we are governed by AI, artificial intelligence, Katie barred the door. If we are governed by technology that is an intelligent assistant to us, okay, where technology then assists us in actually managing the gap, the delta between the pace of evolution and where the technology is going, whether it's Siri or Google or any of these, or education or MOOCs. If technology turns out to be more IA than AI, we have a chance, okay? And that's one part of it. But the other part of it is that I didn't go back to St. Louis Park, my little suburb, for nothing. I went back because for me it is a metaphor or it is a symbol of this subtext of the book, which is that I think the faster the world gets, the more everything that is old and slow matters more than ever. That's why it's called Thank You for Being Late.
Right.
Okay. And so I wish this book could, if you opened it, a song would play, like a Hallmark card you get, you know, when you give someone happy birthday. And the song would be Brandi Carlile. I'm a big Brandi Carlile fan. And she has a song that I think is the song of our time. And it's called The Eye, E-Y-E. And the main refrain is, you can dance in a hurricane as long as you're standing in the eye. And I think what everyone's being asked to do is dance in a hurricane. Okay. And the only way you can do it is if you build an eye. And the eye of a hurricane moves. It draws energy from the hurricane. It moves with the hurricane. But it's a place of stability. And what Trump and these other knuckleheads are selling is a wall to the hurricane. And the hurricane will blow down this wall so fast. But they are all false prophets, but they're right about the storm, okay? And so for me, the book ends in Minnesota as well, because St. Louis Park was my eye of the hurricane. It was both my anchor and my sail. And today, I think to thrive in this world, you need an anchor and a sail.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Tom Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times, and James Manyika, director of McKinsey Global Institute. This episode was recorded before a World Affairs Council audience as part of our Global Business Forum. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our conversation.
Let's pick up on one of the topics you broached here a little bit, which is this: what's happening with technology and jobs and work? Because this is one of the issues that's causing a fair amount of anxiety.
So can I frame a question for you on that? This is what I'm listening to your and having read your book. There's three D's that come to my mind. Debt, demographics, and deflation. And the interaction between the three now, that is, we no longer have the demographic dividend, okay? So we have many more baby boomers like myself retiring.
Right.
Okay, so fewer young people with more debt will have to support our retirement, okay? That's debt and demographics. And then out of nowhere, we have, and Larry Page has spoken about this, the incredible deflationary impacts of technology, making everything cheaper, you know? And so you can't count on inflation. I mean, imagine the pension funds and insurance companies, James, today, mm-hmm. who have obligations of 7-8% to people, made promises, and are getting, what, a tenth of a percent mm-hmm. on their money? I mean, somewhere that straddle is going to explode.
Oh, absolutely.
And so what are your thoughts, Jim, about this triad and how they are going to interact? I would like to have, it's not an acceleration, it's different for me, but how do you think about it?
Well, let me start with the deflationary part and linking to the point about technology. One of the things that's quite extraordinary about most of these technologies that we all love, the mobile internet, cloud computing, all of the internet itself,
right.
We all derive enormous value from it. We mostly don't pay for it,
yep.
right? And so Absolutely. One of the, and it's what economists call consumer surplus, right? So, and by the way, the good news is that consumer surplus is not something new, mm-hmm. Because if you had gone back to the 1950s and tried to size up the economic value associated with anesthesia, the rise of anesthetics, that number is small compared to the societal benefit that we all experience, the fact that we don't have pain.
Yeah.
So there's a, but what's interesting about most of these technologies is we mostly don't pay for them, right? Or we pay very little for them. And that raises the question, because in our economics as currently set up, our GDP metrics don't track that.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So it raises then a question about, so okay, if most of these things end up in consumer surplus, what happens to the economy as we know it in a way that then translates to wages and incomes for different people? So that's a big question that I think we're gonna have to wrestle with, because on the one hand, you could imagine all of us liking these technologies, but we don't actually then, as workers, then derive the wages that come to, because it's not working its way back into the system. Although as consumers, we'll love it, because we all love our free technologies and we benefit from them. So that's actually a big question. In fact, it's ended up raising, you may have tracked the debate between economists like Bob Gordon and others, and even Larry Summers and others. Bob Gordon arguing, these are all great, but none of these are going to transform the economy.
None of them compared to the flush toilet.
Compared to the flush toilet is the argument. So I think that's a big question we're going to need to grapple with. But I want to link it back to the question of even technology and jobs, and I'll come back to the debt and deleveraging. One of the things that's fascinating about technology and jobs, I mean, I think historically, if you had said, where's robotics and these technologies going to automate jobs, right? We would have said all these routine tasks are what we're going to automate the most. And that was largely true for a very long time. But recently, we started to see advances in machine learning and artificial intelligence that actually work in some of these high-end jobs. So all the thinking work, the kinds of things that Watson can do, the kind of things that artificial intelligence can do. So I think that's changed the mixture. So what you see, if you look at the last, say, the last 20 years, what technology has done is had very different impacts at the high end of the skill end, the middle skill categories, and the low skills. At the high end, it's actually been all been great, because what's happened is if you're a doctor or somebody with a high skill at the end, technology mostly complements what you do. That goes back to your AI and AI part of it. It mostly complements and augments what you do. There's a scarcity of people with those skills. And so generally, you ended up with those people in the high end not only being in short supply, but benefiting from technology, and quite frankly, the wages going up.
Right.
What's happened at the other end, at the low skill end, while technology hasn't automated the people who do housework or people who are doing, digging ditches in quite the same way, there's an abundance of labor. So jobs have actually grown at that end, even though the wages haven't gone up.
Yeah.
The piece that's been hurt the most is the middle skill jobs.
Yeah.
So what's happened to the middle skill, that's where we've seen a lot of technology substituting for labor. And so a big part, not the only explanation, but a big part of what you're seeing with the middle income families and workers is the wages have mostly been stagnant. While the top, the wages have been going up. At the bottom, wages may have been stagnant, but those jobs are in abundance.
Yes.
In the middle, wages are going stagnant, and those jobs are also disappearing. So this is a big part of what's been hurting the middle income families. Now, you couple that back to demography, and you think about in a society that's aging, where we have people who are older, living longer, and in fact, populations aren't growing as fast as it used to, there's something called dependency ratios, meaning the burden that working people are going to have to carry to support an economy of many, mostly older people. And you couple that with the fact that most of those people who are working, their wages haven't gone up, they're having to support a much larger burden. And by the way, governments have also been borrowing heavily, promising all kinds of things.
Yeah. So you know, if they're young people, they probably have debt also.
Absolutely. They have debt, but I think so you look at the debt burdens and the fact that we now have a huge number of entitlements, huge promises made by governments. Yeah. Well, working age population that probably won't be earning quite as much as middle income families as much as it used to. And you think, okay, so how are we going to deal with this huge burden we're creating for ourselves? And I think it's a big mess. I think so. These questions about the debt structure of the economy, how we think about wages and jobs, unfortunately, are not things that are in any of these presidential debates by any side.
No,
right? But these are the big structural things
Absolutely.
That we ought to be discussing and debating.
Yeah, it's the way I look at it, James, is that my shorthand for everything you've described is the numbers just don't add up anymore.
They don't.
In a way, and it also is coming at a time when the geopolitics is really, keep my hands down. The geopolitics really is getting much more complicated as well. So you really sense that I think of the period I grew up in. I grew up, first of all, in the Cold War era that had a very enforced stability. But stability it was, for the most part. Then I grew up in the post-Cold War era that had this sort of benign stability, but stability it was. And so now we're in the post-Cold War era. And so all of this math not adding up is happening at a time when, so I believe what actually is going on geopolitically in the world, and my chapter on this is called Get Smart. For those of you, some of you look of my generation, who know the sitcom Get Smart with Don Adams, thank you, Shoe Phone and Agent 99 and Agent 86. But I'm gonna give you a little test. What was the name of the organization Don Adams worked for? Control, very good. What was the name of their opponent?
Chaos.
Chaos, spelled K-A-O-S, okay? And I believe that's the new divide in the world between control and chaos. So I think what's going on today in the world, and that's why it's called Get Smart, is that my three forces in acceleration, what they're doing is they're stressing out strong countries, and they're literally blowing up weak countries. And the countries they're blowing up first are those whose borders are primarily straight lines. So Libya, Syria, Iraq, we helped Iraq, Yemen, Libya, Chad, Mali,
so
Somalia.
Got natural borders.
Exactly. That basically these countries are like caravan homes built on a slab of cement with no foundation and no basement. And what you're seeing now with these three forces is a hurricane go through a trailer park. So average isn't just over for workers. Average is also over for countries. Because during the Cold War, you could be an average little country. Because there are two superpowers to throw money at you, build your government house. If you're Egypt and Syria, you could lose two wars to Israel. They'd rebuild your army. Educate your kids at Patrice Lumumba University in Moscow or Wichita State in America. Give you foreign aid. You could be and there was no China. So China was not a threat to your low-wage labor. Now fast forward to today. Mother Nature, it was 100, and I wrote a column about this, I forgot the number, what was 161 degrees in the Persian Gulf in June, heat index this year. So Mother Nature is doing her thing, hammering these countries. There is no two superpowers to throw money at you. No one wants to touch you unless you're crazy Putin in Syria, because all you win is a bill. And China is there now. So I was in Egypt for Tahrir Square revolution, was there for 3 weeks. Away from my wife, go to Cairo airport to leave. I go into the souvenir shop, buy Mrs. Friedman a little souvenir, because honey's been away for 3 weeks, okay. What would Mrs. Friedman like? Well, let's see, what do they have here? A pyramid's ashtray. Honey doesn't smoke, but neither does Mrs. Friedman, but it'll remind her where her hubby was for 3 weeks. Turn it over, what does it say on the bottom? Made in China. So there's now a country half a world away can make your national icon into an ashtray, okay? And cheaper than you can, ship it and sell it for a profit, okay? So what all these three forces are doing, they are like a hurricane through a trailer park, and they are blowing up these countries. So the new divide in the world is no longer north, south, east, west, communist, capitalist. The new divide in the world is between the world of order and the world of disorder. And what you're seeing going on across the Mediterranean today is tens of thousands of people trying to get out of the world of disorder into the world of order. And if anyone here has a solution for that problem, please see me afterwards, okay?
But I want to follow up on that, though. As you're trying to do a bit of a tour of the world in terms of the hotspots and so order these for me a bit. China, the Middle East, Russia. Do you worry about those more than others in terms of just both.
So I have a lot of, this is the point in the evening where I have to warn people I can ruin any dinner party. And I'm going to do that. James and I are going to eat after. So it's, my deep view, so how did we handle these problems in the past? Mm-hmm. First was by imperialism. So we had the Ottomans control the Middle East for 500 years. And then how did we control them? We controlled it through colonialism. We had the British and French do it. And then how do we control them? We control them through authoritarianism, kings, colonels, and dictators, okay? So that's how we managed a region. So the Arab world is basically a pluralistic region that lacks pluralism, okay? So it's pluralistic character, Sunni, Shiite, Kurds, Druze, Turkmen, Jews, Christians, Yazidis. Its pluralistic character was always managed vertically by an iron fist from the top down. First by the Ottomans, then by the British and French, then by kings, colonels, and dictators. What you're actually seeing in that part of the world is a pluralistic region that lack pluralism, need to go from vertical control to horizontal control, where it's controlled by actually the the different communities forging social contracts to live together as equal citizens, horizontally rather than under each other vertically. And if you want to go from vertical to horizontal, you can do that in one of three ways. One is if you have a Mandela. Turns out there was only one of those, and he never worked the Arab world, okay? Second is if you have a military to take you from vertical to horizontal. We thought the Egyptian army would do that. Turned out they're more interested in preserving their officers' clubs and their hotels that they own. Third is if you have a midwife. That was the role we were going to play. We were going to midwife Iraq, Libya, you know, from vertical to horizontal. Turns out we didn't know what we were doing. If you have no Mandela, no military, no midwife, and you need to go from vertical to horizontal, you have ISIS. Now, my real belief is that, and this is where the dinner party really starts to go south, I believe, James, we're not just in a post-imperial world. I believe we're not just in a post-colonial world. I think we're in a post-authoritarian world. And therefore, the Chinese model, the Putin model, the Sisi model, I don't buy it. I think...
I'm going to make an argument, building on what you said about communities working together and learning to live together. An argument has been made that, in fact, in a world where we can't rely on cohesive power or imperialism to get structure and order, what about trade? We know that, for example, if you have a much more globally entangled, integrated economic system where countries almost depend on each other, things seem to remain stable. And most of these trouble spots are mostly outside of that.
Absolutely.
By and large.
So you just described why I support TPP.
Right.
And why I'm for all these rules-based integrative structures. The place I would take it, James, is I believe that, but I actually believe the ROI on pluralism is going to explode in the age we're going into. So if you actually have pluralism already, as we do, and Lord knows we are a work in progress. We've had Ferguson. Every week there's been an incident now, or the latest one in this school in North Carolina, wherever. But we are so far ahead of everybody else because we've been working at it for 250 years. I mean, say what you want about America, but we have twice now elected a black man whose middle name is Hussein, whose grandfather is a Muslim, who defeated a woman to run against a Mormon, okay? Now, who does that, okay? So, and so we are so far down that road. The returns to America for that, James, I think are going to explode. Not only because of the social stability it provides you in a world where Moore's Law is going like this.
It doesn't feel like that right now.
It doesn't feel like it, but at the same time, because you can collaborate with so many more people in ways you guys have written about to do more things. And the problem with America right now is that the word collaboration means two different things on two different coasts. In this town, it's building great things with other people. And in Washington, D.C., it's in the Vichy French sense of cooperating with the other party, okay? So fortunately, this country isn't Washington, D.C. I want to go back, though, to your point, which is the one I'm stumped on, James. And I am stumped on how do we overcome this income inequality?
That's a tough one.
Now you get to ruin the dinner party.
No. There's a couple of things. I think it's important to understand what seems to be happening. I don't think we fully understand. I mean, obviously, there's one part of it which is we know that if you look just at wages or income, there are huge differences and disparities. That's one thing, and I think Piketty and others have written extraordinarily about that. There's the other thing that's going on, which I think in some ways concerns me even more, which is mobility and the idea that
the idea I'm going to be better.
I'm going to be better off. I mean, I think for the longest time, that was actually true. For the last 50 years, generations, in fact, if you look at different cohort groups, at every income level, at almost at the 90% level, each cohort, social income bracket could count on the next generation being better off almost consistently. That's not true anymore. Yeah. In fact, if you look at it, in fact, we've just been doing some work on this. If you look at it for the United States, from where we are right now, it looks as if something close to 60% of people are not going to be better off.
Yeah.
The children are
right.
Better off. So this idea of mobility,
it's more that math that doesn't work anymore.
It's part of the math that doesn't work anymore. But I think it's complicated because I think on the one hand, it's easy to say, well, you know, arguments are made that it's rich corporations, it's a rich number. But I think it's more complicated than that. For example, we know that, for example, if you look at the structure of the economy, the share of the national income that goes to wages, while still very large, has been declining, mm-hmm. while the share that goes to capital is going up. Now, you could argue it's not really, it's not about greed or not. It's just simply because the
The people who own the machines are getting more return than the people who own labor. Yeah.
So the mixture of the, if you think about what does it take to create an economic output, right? You've got capital and you've got labor and you've got technological advances. Yeah. The mix of those things has actually shifted. It used to be the case, if you'd gone back to 1900, the labor input component, when society was not as automated and technologically capital intensive, was actually much larger.
Yeah.
So no surprise, mm-hmm. the share of labor was very large that went back to labor. But as you automate things, no surprise, the returns to capital
are going
to
go up.
Yeah. So I think we often simplify this debate into just the rich not caring or of course there's some of that, but there's also just the structure of the economy itself is changing. So I think part of thinking about the solution to these things has to grapple with the structural changes in our economy.
Right.
I think I can't imagine a world in which we don't get to some view of rethinking the distributional properties of our economy. I just don't see how you do that. And I think it's also important to think about what do we want to solve for with inequality? Do we want to solve for number of jobs or is it wages? Because it used to be the case that you could do both at the same time. It's okay, you can necessarily do both at the same time.
Play that out a little bit. What do you mean by that?
So, for example, if you said you want everybody to work.
That's my priority, yeah.
That's my priority.
Right.
As long as they're working,
right.
That's my priority. There's ways to do that. In fact, we've seen examples of, actually, one of the fun examples that I love is, take Germany. So in this last recession, Germany actually did something quite interesting. So if you'd looked at the drop in the economy that Germany experienced versus us, they had actually a deeper peak-to-trough drop in GDP output than the U.S. Mm-hmm. did. Yet in that same period, we were losing jobs, they actually kept jobs steady.
Interesting.
They made choices about...
They solved for jobs.
They solved for jobs, reducing work hours, job sharing. There's a whole... So there's things you can do if you say, my goal is I want people to be working.
Yes.
If you say I want people to be earning the same income, the solve is a little bit different. And you get to things like minimum living wages and so forth, and then you run into challenges about, so therefore, will there be enough demand for the labor if I keep the wages very, very high? So I think we're now having to grapple with these choices, whereas before, they kind of went hand in hand.
Interesting.
And by the way, I think one of the fundamental questions we're going to need to grapple with is, the thing we call a job, it's kind of bundled lots of things in it, right? Jobs did lots of things, and nicely, they did all of them nicely, right? It provided an income, it provided a sense of meaning, it provided a sense of contribution to society.
Insurance.
Something to go do, you weren't idle. It did lots and lots of things. But I think as we start to see technology evolve and all these things change, all those things are getting unbundled. We know there's lots of work to be done, that doesn't necessarily have wages to go with it.
Yeah.
That's important.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, our wage structure doesn't reflect how important we think certain things are. Look, you only have to look at what we pay teachers. You only have to look at what we pay, right? We all agree those are important tasks.
Yes.
The wage. So I think we're going to have to grapple with the fact that we may be unbundling this thing we used to call a job. So how do we deal with that? I want to make sure we also weave into this some of the questions that the audience is actually asking us. So there's a couple of things that we haven't covered that have come up in some of the questions. The world is complicated. We talked about jobs and other things, but there are other things. Climate change.
Mm-hmm.
How does that factor into our priorities as we think about priorities to solve for? I mean, what's your view on...
Well, of course, it's one of my three mega forces, so it's something I study a lot. And that chapter is called The Black Elephants, because a friend of mine, Adam Sweden, who's a great environmentalist over in the UK, coined this term. And a black elephant is a combination of a black swan and the elephant in the room, okay? And that is, it's the elephant in the room. Everyone can see it there. That's climate. Everyone can see it there. It's coming. And it has vast exponential consequences that can come all of a sudden, like a black swan. So only it's not going to be a surprise. It's actually staring us right in the face. And that's what this climate problem is. And I spent a lot of time looking at this problem in the Middle East, because my message to people there is that Mother Nature is going to kill you all so much faster than you kill each other. And people don't understand the Syrian conflict. So the whole Syria story has a huge climate component. Oh, awesome. And I did this story for the Years of Living Dangerously documentary last year, and we're going into season two next year on National Geographic. But the Syrian uprising started in the two driest spots in the country, Dar and Qamishli. And if you think that's an accident, you're not paying attention.
So actually, you can even link it back to the Arab uprising. We know that food prices really the big
reach
thing,
all-time
right?
high in absolutely. When? December of 2010, when Tunisia hit. So
absolutely.
All of this has a huge climate dimension. And these countries are completely unprepared. Syria experienced the worst drought in its modern history for the 4 years leading up to the uprising. 1 million Syrian farmers and herders left their homes. Where? In Raqqa province. Where is ISIS headquartered? Raqqa province, okay? They flocked to the cities, completely overwhelmed the infrastructure. Assad did nothing for them. Then they got in their cell phones, so the market met Mother Nature, and they didn't start the revolution, but as soon as it started with the first call of Allahu Akbar, they joined the revolution. And these are all climate refugees.
Well, one of the things that the world has just done that's linked to climate change is the world just agreed to a whole bunch of sustainable development goals.
Yeah.
And climate change is back in there. It was in there the last time, by the way, for the Millennium Development Goals. We didn't make much progress on it. But I'm just curious, what did you make of the sustainable development goals? I mean, I'm happy to give you my take, but I'm just curious. A couple of people
I did
actually
an event on those in New York a couple of weeks ago, and I think they're great, you know, but... you know, one of the problems with green all these years is that the people who named green for so many years in America were the people who hated it. Because I'm a big believer to name something is to own it. Right. And they named it. They named it sissy, girly man, unpatriotic, uncapitalistic, or vaguely French. You know, vaguely French. You know. Mr. Gore, you're looking a little green. You know, you're looking a little French. And my view has always been green is geopolitical, geoeconomic, capitalistic, patriotic. Green is the new red, white, and blue. I think Obama will go down as, I'm sure he would have loved to have done more. I would have loved to have seen him done more. He's actually been quietly amazing on this issue. What he did in changing the mileage standards. No coal-fired power plant will ever be built new from here going forward in this country. And I think we're getting to that point. And again, I was just at Nest today. And you know what? You know, think about the Saudis did. You know, oil's around $110 a barrel, and they decide, let's take out North Dakota. Okay, right. Let's take out North Dakota. I'm tired of these guys in North Dakota. Bunch of farmers challenging us. Okay, we're bringing the price down to $70. Technology says we can make money at $70. Fine, we'll bring it to 60. We can make money at 60. We'll bring it to 50. We can make money at 50. We'll bring it to 40. We make money at 40. And the other thing the Saudis miss is that Nest. And Google and Apple are now energy companies. They build megawatts, okay? They are energy efficiency companies. Google buying Nest and Apple's home energy system on your iPhone, you know, and I can watch my daughter turn down the air conditioning in her home in Washington from Colorado. You know, Grandma always said, never compete against Google and Apple. You know, and it was just a little thing Grandma said. And so Saudi Arabia is now competing against Google and Apple. They are they're direct competitors now. And, right. and Google and Apple are just saying, bring it on. You know what I mean?
But at least the one thing I also take heart in is at least, you know, it looks as if we're on the verge of getting some real global agreements on.
And I think it'll be very important. I think Paris is going to work. And in the sense that, unlike Copenhagen, which is a disaster that I got to see firsthand, I think you're basically going to come out of Paris with a feeling that climate change is real. Everyone's signing up to do something. It's the message, because I believe, you know, energy climate is a scale problem. And if you don't have a scale solution, you have a hobby.
Right.
And I like hobbies. I used to build model airplanes. I wouldn't try to change the climate as a hobby, you know. And there's only one thing as big as Mother Nature, and that's Father Greed,
right,
the market. And I think what you're seeing now is the market taking over, and I think we'll look back, and Paris will be the tipping point. It's going to signal all these business leaders, and when that starts to happen, this will happen for all the reasons you discuss in No Ordinary Disruption. It's going to happen so much faster than people realize.
There's several questions that relate to the question about just women in the economy. It also, as we know, one of the key goals in the SDGs was actually gender parity.
Yeah.
And there's a related question about when are we ever going to discuss things like equal pay for women?
But you guys have done work on that. What do you think?
We have, but I wanted to hear your view too. Mm-hmm. But I'm happy to describe it, but I want to.
I mean, I'm not. I don't have, other than to say I'm all for it. I don't have enough knowledge on that one. You know.
I guess what I will say, at least from some of the work we've done, it's actually quite remarkable. This is one of those issues that, you know, for a long time people thought the issues around gender parity and women were just things for poor countries to think about and developing countries to think about. It's here too. We know, you know, presidential debate has a hard time grappling with the issue of equal wages for women. I mean, we can't even get our minds around that, things like family leaves and so forth. But I think, you know, at least from the work we've done, two numbers are actually interesting, 28 trillion and 12 trillion. Mm-hmm. So 28 trillion, that's the number if you said, look, I want to look at gender parity. If women could participate in the economy at exactly the same rate, so by that I mean equal hours, equal wages, getting paid for unpaid care work. There's a whole variety of parity, equal access to capital, all of which affect not just the developing world, but the US too. If you could magically wave a magic wand and get to parity, that's the 28 trillion number that you'd add to global GDP. It's a big number. Mm. If you say, well, that's unrealistic, we'll never get there, cultures, different geographies, and you know the issues we see in our politics, then you get to the 12 trillion number. What's interesting about that number, that's the number if you said, what if every country in the world did as well as some other country in its neighborhood that's making progress. Hmm. So in Latin America, that would be Chile, which is making the most progress compared to other countries in that neighborhood. In the Middle East, it's actually the Emirates. Mm-hmm. In the advanced world, the US actually isn't quite the best. Canada does a little bit better. So if you've got everybody to do as good as the best performer in their neighborhood, that's how you get to 12 trillion. Wow. The point about that is these are issues not just for the developing world, but I wanted to bring it back to the US, where we still struggle with these issues. Yeah. About women participation rates and gender rates and either in companies or in the economy and so forth that we don't handle very well and can't seem to get comfortable discussing it in a political sense.
If we do have a woman president, and I think there's a 50% chance we will, I can't think of anything that, I'm a huge believer in the bully pulpit of the presidency, that would give more of a fillip to gender equality than that. And right. I don't know enough about the economics of it, but I think that that would have a huge impact.
I think that's a good note to end on.
Great, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Featured in this program were Tom Friedman of the New York Times and James Manyika, director of the McKinsey Global Institute. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org to watch a video of this broadcast, to register for upcoming events, or to become a council member. World Affairs is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.